Time now to begin our first study. The world by wisdom knew not God. Father Jonathan.
Acts chapter 17 and verse 16, brothers and sisters. In this study, we shall go initially with Paul to Athens, and then briefly to Corinth. We shall also consider, God willing, what Paul says in his epistle to the Colossians regarding the dangers of human philosophy. And if time permits, we will consider the danger in this for the Ecclesia today. Acts chapter 17 and verse 16. Now, while Paul waited for them at Athens, the apostle here was waiting for Silas and Timotheus to join him from Berea, from which place Paul had been sent away on account of trouble stirred up by the Jews of Thessalonica, where almost wherever Paul went, he encountered trouble. And at Berea was no exception. But Berea, in verse 11, we see it was the place where those who received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily whether those things were so. That was the place that he had had to leave. And many of them believed. And so Paul had had to leave a spiritually congenial atmosphere, and he was conducted to Athens and left there alone. We're going to see that this wasn't a pleasant experience for Paul. Paul was happier when he was with his companions, but he was left at Athens alone, waiting. Waiting in what was the greatest centre of Greek learning, philosophy and religion. It was an atmosphere which was hostile to the truth. A place where the refined thinking of the flesh was at the pinnacle of cultural sophistication. An environment which was also hostile to Paul. In person, Paul, as we shall see, being brought under the scrutiny of the court of the Areopagites. And we find Paul here brought to a point of crisis. A point of crisis which made a considerable impression upon him, the evidence of which can be seen in his subsequent teaching at Corinth. Verse 16, now while Paul waited, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Now there is one Greek writer who has recorded that there were more statues in Athens than in all the rest of Greece put together. And in his years of study of the law as a young man in Jerusalem, Paul would not have seen, he would not even have seen such representations of the human form, this being contrary to the law. And to a Jew like Paul, it would have been a nauseating sight. In that city also, there was a multiplicity of pagan temples. Temples whose architectural magnificence was unsurpassed. It was here that poetry, music, philosophy and art reached their greatest sophistication in the ancient world. But it was all the product of the carnal mind. And Paul is quite uncompromising. He says when he writes to Corinth, "The world by wisdom knew not God." But, brethren and sisters, if we suppose it had been possible for the world to know God by its wisdom, if it had been possible for the flesh on its own, unaided, to know God, then it would have been here at Athens. Here was the flesh in all its sophistication. And so in verse 15, he sends instructions for Silas and Timothy to come with all speed. And Paul is going to have to be patient because Berea is 200 miles to the north of Athens. And so this message has got to go 200 miles to the north. And then Silas and Timotheus have got to return with all speed. And we can see that Paul is left alone, waiting for them in Athens. And what is his reaction to all this? His spirit was roused to anger, as the word means, within him. It's the word stirred in the Authorized Version. His reaction to these feelings was to go into the synagogue, verse 17, and there reason with the Jews and with the devout persons in the market, in the agora, daily, with them that met him. And so, hoping for the arrival of Silas and Timotheus, he puts his back into the work of the truth as best he can in adverse circumstances. And we presume that it was in the agora, the marketplace, that in verse 18 certain philosophers of the Epicureans and Stoics encountered him. And from these men, from these philosophers, there were two reactions to the word of Paul. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, some, "He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." Now we shall consider the beliefs of the Stoics and the Epicureans in due course, but let's look first at what they said. The first of these two reactions was a condescending one. It was one of intellectual condescension. "What will this babbler say?" And they used an interesting Greek word. It's the word spermologos, which literally means a seed picker. It was a word used of crows and other seed-picking birds. But it was also used at Athens as a contemptuous nickname. It was used to describe thieves or men who gathered scraps of information from others, pickers up of learning's crumbs, and those who talked of things which were beyond their own understanding. Now this was no doubt irritating and wearing, but Paul was not a proud man. He was a man who'd been humbled. But these members of these two philosophical schools, based in Athens, clearly treated Paul with contempt. Well, at least one group of these philosophers did. But there was another reaction to Paul, which was more ominous. "But others, some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange demons," that's the word, "because he preached unto them Jesus and Anastasis." They mistakenly supposed that Anastasis, that is, the resurrection, was the name of one of Paul's foreign demons, which he set forth. They must have presumed that it was a goddess, as the word is feminine in the Greek. Now, this statement was more ominous, because he seemeth to be, and there is a note of uncertainty there, he seemeth to be a setter forth of foreign demons. Now, a demon to the Greek was a lesser god, a lesser deity. There was a whole pantheon of gods which the Greeks reverenced, and these were the lesser gods. But these gods, which Paul appeared in their mind to set before them, these were not gods of the state. And although it's not explicitly stated, it can be reasonably inferred from the contents of the following verse that they conferred amongst themselves and decided that Paul should be made to give account of himself in the court of the Areopagus. At this point, I'd like to draw attention to the phrase used by Paul's potential accusers. Here, the phrase, "setter forth." He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange demons. The Greek word here is katangelios. At this point, we shall just note that word and return to it later, because there's another very closely related word that Paul uses himself later on. And clearly, there is a link between what he says later and this idea here. And we'll return to that. Now, it was quite normal for cities in the Roman Empire to regulate as to which gods should be worshipped there. The Romans permitted the application of local religious laws, as was the case at Jerusalem also. And here we read of certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics. And this is the only place in the New Testament where the word philosopher occurs. The word philosophy also occurs only once in the New Testament, and that's in Colossians chapter 2 verse 8, which we shall look at in due course. Here in Acts chapter 17, Paul is contending against philosophy in the world. But in Colossians chapter 2, he's contending against philosophy in the ecclesia. If time permits, we hope to consider later the danger of philosophy within the Ecclesia. We believe that this subject has a very real bearing upon the well-being of the Ecclesia today. Now, the word philosopher means a lover of wisdom. We won't turn to it now because we should go there later. But when Paul writes to Corinth, he says, "The Jews require a sign and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But the wisdom which they sought was just the refined ideas of the flesh." And Brother Richard last night talked about how sophisticated the flesh could be. And he said that refined flesh is the most dangerous. And the Greeks sought after the refined ideas of the flesh. Verse 19 records, "And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus." The Diaglot renders this, "And laying hold of him, they led him to the Areopagus." The word means to take hold of, to seize. It's the same word used in the previous chapter, chapter 16 and verse 9, when Paul was at Philippi. We read there, it isn't verse 9, it's a bit later on, verse 19, sorry, yes. "When her masters saw that the hope of their gains was gone," this is the damsel possessed with the spirit of divination, "when they saw that the hope of their gains was gone, they caught Paul and Silas and drew them unto the marketplace, unto the rulers." They caught hold of Paul, and that's the same word. And we find it also in chapter 18 and verse 17 with regard to Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue. It says there, verse 17, "Then all the Greeks took Sosthenes, the chief ruler of the synagogue, and beat him before the judgment seat." And so this man was forcibly taken and beaten. Now Paul, brothers and sisters, in Acts 17, was not invited to give a dissertation. He was taken. And while this may not have been a formal arrest, he was certainly compelled to go. He was taken to a court, to the Areopagus. What was the Areopagus? The Areopagus was the hill of Ares, the Greek god of war. This god corresponded to the Roman god Mars. And the Areopagus was, and still is, a rock opposite the western end of the Acropolis. The top of the rock was about 50 or 60 feet above the valley. There were steps which led from the agora, or marketplace, below, up to the top of the hill. And this rock was called the Hill of Ares because, according to Greek tradition, the god Ares was brought to trial there before the gods by Neptune. Now this rock was in the shadow of the Parthenon, the great temple on the Acropolis, which honoured Athena the Virgin, the goddess of war. And the rock, this rock, was the most ancient and venerated court of Athens, and there on the top of the rock, upon stone benches, sat the council of the Areopagus. There are probably some here in this audience who have actually been there. I certainly haven't. But we can, with almost certainty, see where Paul went at that location, if we were to visit the place. And so Paul was taken up the steps from the agora below to the top of the rock. Now there is no evidence in Acts chapter 17 of any formal charges being laid against Paul, or indeed of any formal proceedings being started. But Paul was certainly now under the scrutiny of the council. The allegation had been made in the agora that he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange demons, and that charge had to be answered. These were not gods of the state. And so in the middle of verse 19, we find them saying to Paul, "May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is, for thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know therefore what these things mean." And then Luke adds a note regarding the character of the Athenian people generally in verse 21. "For all the Athenians and strangers that were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some newer thing." They wanted newer things. It might well be that the main reason for bringing Paul to the Areopagus was their curiosity to know. And I'm sure that this was part of it. But on the other hand, that court had traditionally regarded itself as the guardian of Athens' religion and morals. Now, the allegation made against Paul was, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods or demons. It's rather significant that this was the very same charge that centuries earlier had been brought against Socrates, the philosopher, by the religious and philosophical authorities of Athens. It might even have been to that same rock that Socrates was taken. If I might quote briefly from the writing of the British philosopher Bertrand Russell on this subject. This man Russell wrote a very interesting history of Western philosophy. It's a book which has limited use, but one which certainly is very informative about the philosophies of the flesh and that wisdom which is from beneath. And this is what he says. They, the prosecutors, maintained that Socrates was guilty of not worshipping the gods of the state, but introducing other new divinities, and further, that he was guilty of corrupting the young by teaching them accordingly. We'd also note that Socrates was condemned to take hemlock, a poison from which he subsequently died. Now, it was unlikely that Paul was to be treated in this way, but no doubt it was an experience to be treated with some trepidation, to be taken before that court to give answer to it. So when they said he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange demons, this was a potentially serious allegation against Paul. We mention this because it has a significant bearing on what Paul says in the speech which follows. Now, in a few moments, we shall see how Paul very skillfully demolishes this charge. And of course, it wasn't Paul's own skill, because Paul spoke by the Spirit. Verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, and that word Mars Hill in the Greek is Areopagus, the same word as in verse 19. You'll notice that the Authorised Version margin has an explanatory note there. It in the margin, against the word Mars Hill, it has a note to the effect, the court of the Areopagus, and that's what it was. Paul stood up in the midst of the court of the Areopagites and said, and so begins Paul's speech. And perhaps we should note at this stage that this speech was not finished. It was cut short by their mocking him in verse 32. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked, and others said, we will hear thee again of this matter. So Paul departed from among them, having been effectively dismissed as unworthy of further consideration by that august body. He says that he stood in the midst, it says he stood in the midst of the Areopagus, that is, in the middle of the assembly area on the top of the rock. And this is what Paul said, verse 22. Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill and said, ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious. I see how in everything ye are fearful of demons, as it literally means. They were unusually reverent to the gods. Verse 23. For as I passed by and beheld your devotions, that is, your objects of worship, I found an altar, a shrine, with this inscription, to an unknown God. And he says, verse 23, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare I unto you. Now that word declare is the Greek word katangelo, which means to proclaim, to preach, or announce. And here Paul is picking up the language which his accusers used in verse 18, in that word to which we drew attention earlier, when they said, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods. The word there in verse 18, as we indicated earlier, is katangelios. And these two words are, for all practical purposes, simply just different parts of speech of the same basic Greek word. You see, Paul is effectively answering the charge of verse 18. If we were to render the verses in the following manner, the connection would be obvious. Verse 18, the charge was, he seemeth to be an announcer of strange gods. Verse 19, Paul's defence was, as I passed by, I found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him announce I unto you. We see the connection, it's as close as that, I believe, in the Greek. This is Paul's defence. The charge of in verse 18 of setting forth of foreign demons simply collapses at this point, because Paul was able to show that the deity which he announced to them was already venerated by them in ignorance at the altar to which he refers. And from this point on, there was now very little possibility that a formal indictment could be brought against Paul. And for the men of that council, all that remained now was for them to exhaust their intellectual curiosity to hear some newer thing. Now, if we're to see the proper force of what Paul says in the next few verses, it's necessary for us to know a little about the philosophical schools mentioned in verse 18, the Epicureans and the Stoics. Now, Luke, in his account, says nothing by way of explanation as to what the Epicureans and Stoics were, besides telling us that they were certain philosophers. We can only assume that Theophilus, to whom the Acts was originally addressed, was aware of the nature of these philosophies. Now, one view of Paul's speech in Acts chapter 17, which we find in the writings of some of the Orthodox commentators, and this view is certainly not mine, is that Paul here was being very conciliatory towards these philosophers and was attempting to court them by using their language and appealing to their philosophical ideas. I hope by the time that we have considered Paul's speech here, we shall see that this is definitely not the case. We shall see, to the contrary, that Paul takes them head on, and what he says is pointedly against their philosophies, and in particular against the Epicurean philosophy. This is the wisdom of God against the wisdom of the world. Now, in the Herald of the Kingdom and Age to Come, which has been reprinted in its entirety, Brother Thomas had a section entitled The Court of the Gentiles, and this actually ran through quite a number of issues. And in that section, he had a number of short articles about the different philosophies of the Gentiles, so that his readers could be aware of the subtleties of the thinking of the flesh. And in the Herald for May 1861, there was a short piece on the Epicureans, and I'd like to quote to you from this because it's quite instructive. Epicureanism, it's headed, the founder of the Epicurean branch of the wisdom from beneath, from the depths of the carnal mind, and that is indeed where it was from, was Epicurus, who flourished in Greece 270 years before Christ and after the translation of the Septuagint, not many years. The Epicureans maintained that the world arose from chance. There's something quite surprisingly modern about this, isn't there? That the gods whose existence they did not dare to deny, neither did nor could extend their providential care to human affairs. That the soul was mortal, that pleasure was to be regarded as the ultimate end of man, and that virtue was neither worthy of esteem nor choice, but with a view to the attainment of pleasure. Now, that was the philosophy of the Epicureans. Pleasure is supposed, it continues, by some to mean in this system not only sensual pleasure, but to comprehend moral and intellectual pleasures. That was the philosophy of the Epicureans as described by Brother Thomas in the Herald. But we must, however, add to that that what the Epicureans meant by pleasure was the absence of pain. Pleasure which involved any pain or discomfort was to be avoided at all costs. And as a result, Epicurus himself was very abstemious. Because, for example, if he ate too much, he was likely to get stomachache, so he ate very frugally. Epicurus, brothers and sisters, was not an epicure. In fact, Epicurus has been described as being more stoical than the Stoics. He said, "When I live on bread and water, I spit on luxurious pleasures." Epicurus' pleasures were very much simple pleasures. Simple pleasures of the body, and in particular the pleasures of the mind. Epicurus believed that mental pleasure was the highest pleasure. Now, the Epicureans totally rejected the notion of life after death in any form, believing the soul to be mortal. To them, life after death implied divine judgment, and divine judgment would involve pain, and pain was contrary to their philosophy, believing in pleasure. Now, Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, with whose writings I'm sure some of you are familiar, he wrote about the Epicureans in his work, The Antiquities of the Jews. Josephus wrote the Antiquities in explanation of those things Jewish to the Gentiles, to the Greeks in particular. And he has a section in there, in the Antiquities, Book 10, which deals with the visions of Daniel. And what he says about the visions of Daniel is in fact quite interesting, and in many respects Josephus had a certain degree of understanding of the prophecy of Daniel. I'm going to quote to you from Antiquities Book 10. This is what he says, and he's just described the vision of the image and the ram and the he-goat of the image of Daniel 2 and the ram and the he-goat of Daniel chapter 8. He says this: "In the very same manner," we remember that Josephus was a man who was contemporary with Paul, and he wrote these things, in fact, after the destruction of Judah's commonwealth in AD 70. "In the very same manner, Daniel also wrote concerning the Roman government, and that our country should be made desolate by them. All things did this man leave in writing as God had showed them to him, insomuch that such as read his prophecies and see how they have been fulfilled would wonder at the honour wherewith God honoured Daniel." And notice these words: "And may thence discover how the Epicureans are in error, who cast providence out of human life, and do not believe that God takes cares of the affairs of the world, nor that the universe is governed and continued in being by that blessed and immortal nature, but say that the world is carried along of its own accord, without a ruler and a curator, which were it destitute of a guide to conduct, as they imagine, it would be like ships without pilots, which we see drowned by the winds, or like chariots without drivers, which are overturned. So," he says, "would the world be dashed to pieces by its being carried without a providence, and so perish and come to naught. So," he says, "that by the forementioned predictions of Daniel, those men, the Epicureans, seem to me very much to err from the truth, who determine that God exercises no providence over human affairs. For if that were the case, that the world went on by mechanical necessity," that's what they believe, that the world was carried along by mechanical necessity, "we should not see that all things would come to pass according to his prophecy." Now, the Epicureans were atomists. They believed that the universe consisted entirely of the random interaction of atoms, and everything was explicable by this. The atoms were variously shaped and had no purpose or qualities except size or shape. Every object in the world and in the universe was a combination of atoms, including the human soul. It was a materialist philosophy, and in many respects it bears a comparison to the modern scientific outlook. In fact, in the 19th century there was a great revival of interest in the philosophy of the Epicureans, and we can see that some of it has in fact come forward into our day. Like men, the gods were also made of atoms, and they were subjected to severe limitations. In any case, the gods, according to Epicurus, were rational hedonists like Epicurus himself, and therefore didn't bother themselves with public affairs. Just like people in the world today who are quite prepared to believe in a god provided he is one who doesn't interfere in the world. Now, the Epicurean was happy to limit the gods and cast them out of human affairs because by this they did not have to fear the gods. Fear was mental pain, and their philosophy taught them to desire pleasure as the absence of pain. The gods put no moral demands upon men, neither was divine anger directed to man. Now the Stoics, on the other hand, and you'll be quite relieved to know that we're not going to say very much about the Stoics. The Stoics were founded by Zeno, a Phoenician, whose school of philosophy, like that of Epicurus, settled in Athens. And Zeno taught that there was no such thing as chance, quite the opposite to the Epicureans, and that the course of nature was rigidly determined by natural laws. The Stoic idea is very much more difficult to penetrate than the Epicureans. Their views seem to have changed more rapidly during their history. But their moral philosophy emphasised virtue as accepting predetermined circumstances without complaining. It was a philosophy which emphasised personal control and discipline, and it gloried in the flesh, brothers and sisters, in this respect. To the Stoic, virtue resided in the will. A man had a good will if he remained indifferent to external happenings. And they were austere, and unlike the Epicureans, were totally indifferent to pleasure. Hence the modern use of the word Stoic to describe an austere person who represses emotion or is indifferent to pleasure or pain. And this, even this has come forward into our culture. This country, in its education, was obsessed with the classical learning of Greece and Rome, and the British stiff upper lip is probably derived, which is now part of our national character, is probably derived from the philosophy of the Stoics, which was perhaps the more dominant of the two philosophies in the Roman Empire. And so in Acts chapter 17 and 24, this is what Paul says. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. And there's a curious thing here, brothers and sisters. The Stoics and the Epicureans were intellectual philosophers, but they were also closely involved in the worship of the gods. We earlier suggested that the Epicureans in particular had taken the power away from the gods, and they had. Just like people today, they're prepared to acknowledge and even venerate the existence of God, providing he does not interfere in the real world. And the Epicureans had certainly cut the gods down to size, but they were still quite happy to participate in the worship of the temples and so on in Athens. And here was Paul saying these words in the shadow of the Parthenon, that great temple in Athens. And how diametrically opposed is the true God whom Paul preached to the conceptions of the Epicureans and Stoics. God that made the world and all things therein, he says. But Epicurus believed that it was all the result of the random interaction of atoms. And as far as him being the Lord of heaven and earth was concerned, the Stoic believes heaven and earth to be predetermined by natural laws. Verse 25, neither is worship with men's hands as though he needeth anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things. The Athenians had spared no effort to venerate the various gods which they worshipped in their temples with their statues and shrines. The city was full of the works of men's hands. And this implied that the gods of Athens needed considerable support from men. But Paul says that the God which he proclaimed to them was in need of nothing and did not recognize, did not require the work of men's hands to satisfy his need. And it's rather interesting there that the statement at the end of verse 24, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, is in fact taken from the words of Stephen in his speech when talking to the Jews at Jerusalem, howbeit the Most High dwelleth in temples made with hands, suggesting that there was something in common here with the attitude of the Athenians to that of the Jews in Jerusalem with regard to venerating God through the temple, the works of men's hands. Verse 26, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitations. He is a God, says Paul, who interferes in the real world. He is a God who exercises provident control over the affairs of this world. He's stating here a view, an understanding diametrically opposed to that of the Epicurean philosophers verse 27, that they should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us. Verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being, as certain also of our own poets have said, of your own poets rather, have said, we are also his offspring. And this is perhaps one verse which the Orthodox commentators seize upon. They would, being classical scholars themselves, many of them would just love to have Paul in their camp, and they cite this as evidence that Paul had a taste for Greek poetry. I suggest, brothers and sisters, that that is a very poor argument to put. Paul here simply points out to them that their own writers, and you've got to remember that a lot of the philosophical ideas of the time were actually written in poetry, not in prose, and that was true of the Epicurean philosophy. Much of it was actually written in poetry. So their own writers had acknowledged the fact that man was the offspring of God. He's simply pointing out that fact. It's nothing more than that. For as much then as we are the offspring of God, he says, this is a point where we're supposed to agree. We ought not to think that the Godhead is likened to gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. Man was created in the image of God for the purpose of being the means of manifestation of God. That's why man was created in the image and likeness of the deity. But the Athenians venerated and worshipped God and saw the gods manifested through the statues and shrines and the works of men's hands. We ought not to think that the Godhead is likened to gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. And the times of this ignorance God winked at, but now commanded all men everywhere to repent. And so he is a God, says Paul, who puts moral demands upon men, completely contrary to the philosophy of the Epicureans. To them, pleasure was the true virtue, and therefore a religious system which put moral demands upon men was contrary to their feeling and of their thinking. Because he hath appointed the day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead. Again, the idea of divine judgment of men was rejected by the Epicureans. They had cut the gods down to size so that they couldn't vent their anger upon men. But Paul says, the true God, the God which is unknown to you, there is a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness. And he's quoting there, of course, from the Psalms. By that man whom he hath ordained, whereof he hath given assurance. You notice what the margin there says there. Or offered faith unto all men, in that he hath raised him from the dead. The resurrection of Jesus offered reasonable proof and assurance. It was an offer of faith to men. It gave the grounds of faith and belief in the fact that the day would come when God would judge the world in righteousness by that same man. He hath offered faith unto all men in that he hath raised him from the dead. I'd like to quote to you, just so you can see how Paul here is taking on and opposing the philosophy of these men. I'd like to quote to you from the poem of Lucretius, singing the praises of Epicurus. And this of Epicurus, this is what he said: when this our life lay crushed before men's eyes, beneath the yoke of faith, they saw faith as an undesirable yoke, like the moderns do today, who from on high with horrid aspect frightened mortal hearts. It was a Greek himself, a mortal too, who first had courage to lift up his eyes and to her face withstand her. Tales of gods and thunderbolts from heaven with all their threats were impotent to slay him. So at last, faith in its turn lies trampled underfoot, and we through him have triumphed over heaven. This was the arrogance of these philosophers. And Paul says, he hath given assurance unto all men, in that he has raised him from the dead. He has offered faith unto all men. The time is coming when he will judge the world in righteousness, and man will be shown to be morally accountable to his Creator. Verse 32. And when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked And others said, we will hear thee again of this matter. And so Paul was cut short. Their curiosity was now exhausted. They ridiculed and mocked the idea of the resurrection of the dead. And so Paul, I'm sure with great relief, goes down those steps from the Areopagus, having freed himself from their clutches. So Paul departed from among them. Verse 34. Howbeit, certain men clave unto him and believed. And so the work of Paul here wasn't entirely without fruit, among the which was Dionysius the Areopagite, and he was a member of the Areopagus Council itself, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. Chapter 18, verse 1. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and came to Corinth. I believe, brothers and sisters, that this was a premature departure. Paul had expected to have to wait there for some time for Silas and Timotheus to arrive, but he had left them a message to come with all speed. And that's in verse 16 of the previous chapter. He'd sent a message which had to go 200 miles to the north, and then Silas and Timotheus had to come from Berea. It was a long way. And there is no record of the arrival of Silas and Timotheus at Athens before Paul's departure. It suggests that Paul felt pressed to leave Athens, this hostile place where the wisdom of man reigned supreme, where the refinements of flesh had reached a sophistication unparalleled anywhere in the dominion of Rome. In fact, if we look at verse 5 of chapter 18, we see how that Silas and Timotheus don't catch up with Paul until he has been at Corinth for some time. Verse 5. Verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath and persuaded the Jews and the Greeks. And when Silas and Timotheus were come from Macedonia, Paul was pressed in the spirit and testified to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. So Silas and Timotheus come at this point, and it's here where they meet again with Paul. And how relieved he must have been to be with his close companions in the truth once again. And the implication is that they had indeed, as instructed by Paul, gone to Athens and had diligently looked for him there, but had eventually learned of his departure to Corinth, and so had followed him to that place. Corinth wasn't very far away from Athens, but Corinth was a very different place to Athens. Both places were given over totally to the flesh. But whereas Athens was a place of great sophistication, Corinth was not so. Athens was flesh refined. Corinth was flesh unrefined, a place known for its immorality, and where the flesh presented itself without bothering with the trimmings of cultural sophistication. It was here that the base things of the world were to be found. If you wanted flesh in the raw, it wasn't Athens that you went to, it was Corinth. But it was at Corinth that the truth was to prosper. And it's not surprising when we think about it. Brother Richard last night showed us how that refined flesh is the most prejudicial to the interests of the truth. And in Corinth, Paul was free from the intellectual condescensions of the Stoics and Epicureans. He wasn't treated as a matter of intellectual curiosity. And at Corinth, the flesh could be seen more clearly for what it was. It didn't act in such a pretentious way as it did at Athens. And in Acts chapter 8, verse 9, we read, then spake the Lord to Paul in the night by a vision, be not afraid, but speak and hold thy peace, for I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee to hurt thee, for I have much people in this city. And Paul's work there was to be very fruitful indeed. But notice in passing, as an aside, the words, be not afraid. We talked last night of the sufferings of Paul. Do we suppose that Paul didn't experience fear? Well, he did, brethren and sisters. Be not afraid, but speak and hold thy peace, for I am with thee, and no man shall set on thee. And so briefly, he has relief from perils like that, and his work is able to prosper at Corinth. Be not afraid. Turn with me now to 1 Corinthians and chapter 1. We suggested at the beginning of our study that Athens had made a considerable impression on Paul, the evidence of which can be seen in his subsequent preaching at Corinth. Paul now had experimental knowledge of the wisdom of the flesh at its very height. And he leaves Athens with the total antagonism between the wisdom of God and the wisdom of the world indelibly impressed upon his mind. These are two systems of wisdom which are totally at odds with one another. 1 Corinthians chapter 1 verse 17. For Christ sent me not to baptize but to preach the gospel, not with the wisdom of words, lest the stake of Christ should be made of none effect. Not with the wisdom of words. For the preaching of the stake is to them that perish foolishness, but unto us which are saved it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and I will bring to naught the understanding of the prudent. And how Paul longed for that day. Where is the scribe? Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the disputer of this world? Hath not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Verse 21, for after that in the wisdom of God, the world by wisdom knew not God. And it was in God's wisdom that that should be the case, that the world by its own wisdom should not know its creator. It pleased God by the foolishness of the thing preached to save them that believe. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. But unto them which are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. Because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For ye see your calling, brethren, how that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. He hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And it was at Corinth that there was to be much fruit in the preaching of the truth, not at Athens. It was away from the cultural sophistication of that awful place. Verse 28, and base things of the world, and things which are despised hath God chosen. Yea, and all things which are not, to bring to naught the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. And we can think of the Stoic with his philosophy, which required him to maintain a proud detachment from all the adversity around him, and how it appealed to the flesh, and how the Greeks would glory in that, brothers and sisters, that no flesh should glory in his presence, said Paul. But of him are ye in Christ Jesus, who of God is made unto us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that according as it is written, he that glorieth, let him glory in Yahweh. The wisdom of man glories the flesh, but the wisdom of God brings glory ultimately to Yahweh. And I, brethren, he says, when I came to you at Corinth, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God. For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And we saw the fact that it was revealed to Paul that he need not fear, that no hurt would come to him in his work there. But Paul was no Stoic. He didn't practice indifference to circumstances. He was seen amongst the Corinthians in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power. In conclusion then, I'd like to go to Colossians. We must briefly mention this before I sit down, because Paul also had to combat philosophy within the ecclesia. And this is where it is the most dangerous. Brother Richard last night says refined flesh is the most dangerous. And philosophy reared its ugly head at Colossae, evidently, on the basis of what Paul says. In Colossians chapter 1, there is a lovely section there describing the relationship of Christ to the ecclesia, verse 18. He is the head of the body, the ecclesia, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he might have the preeminence. But in chapter 2, he says, verse 8, "Beware lest any man spoil you through philosophy and vain deceit, after the tradition of men, after the rudiments of the world, and not after Christ." And at Colossae, Brother Richard quite rightly pointed out last night that the Judaizers had had an effect, but the philosophers had also had an effect as well. It was a perverse admixture of elements of Judaism and elements of Greek philosophy which had come into the ecclesia and were prejudicing its spiritual development. And so he says, verse 18, "Let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility." Things devised by the thinking of men, and how the philosophy of men is capable of inventing rules and aspects of behaviour which it elevates to being the will of God himself. "But let no man beguile you of your reward in a voluntary humility and a worshipping of angels, intruding into those things which he hath not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind. These things appeal to the flesh." Verse 20, "Wherefore, if ye be dead with Christ from the rudiments of the world, why, as though living in the world, are ye subject to ordinances? Touch not, taste not, handle not, which are all to perish with the using after the commandments and doctrines of men." And these prohibitions and rules which the Colossians took upon themselves came from the philosophers and the Judaizers. And what were they doing? By following after the dictums of men, verse 19, "and not holding the head, from which all the body by joints and bands, having nourishment, ministered and knit together, increasing with the increaseth with the increase of God." It was the head, it was Christ that was supposed to direct the body. Brethren and sisters, the ecclesia is to be directed by Christ and by the thinking of Christ, the thinking of the head, not the thinking of men. And how easy it is for the flesh to go its own way and in many little ways introduce its own rules, touch not, taste not, handle not, which are all to perish by the using. And when this happens, when personal crotchets are elevated, they are put in place of what is found in God's word, when the human mind starts to reason independently of what God has revealed here in the world, in the word, we are not holding the head. We are following after the dictates of the flesh, which things have indeed, verse 23, a show of wisdom in will worship and humility and neglecting of the body, not in any honour to the satisfying of the flesh. Will worship and humility, and that might well be the influence of the Stoics who worshipped the will. But here's the exhortation to us, brothers and sisters. Human philosophy focuses the mind on things below. But our duty then, if ye be risen with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on the earth. For ye are dead, and your life is hid with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall ye also appear with him in glory.